Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, July 15th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. First vote scheduled on infrastructure spending in the Senate. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer setting the test vote on the bipartisan portion of the plans for next Wednesday. But details of that bipartisan bill are still being negotiated. Some Senate Republicans say it's too soon for a vote. We'll hear from some Senate leaders and get an update from a Washington Post reporter. The enhanced child tax credit monthly payments begin today. Money directly deposited into families' bank accounts in most cases. President Joe Biden calling it a giant step toward ending childhood poverty in America. With coronavirus cases on the upswing again, the Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, warning that COVID-19 misinformation is an urgent public health threat that has cost us lives. And President Joe Biden meets with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the White House. Some of the topics: climate change, COVID, and relations with Russia. From thehill.com, Republicans are bristling over Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's hardball strategy to try to force them to finalize a bipartisan infrastructure deal in a matter of days. Republican negotiators and members of leadership believe Schumer is trying to jam them and warn that they won't vote to start debate even on a shell bill that the Democratic leader is intending to use as a vehicle for the bipartisan deal once it's finalized. Senator Schumer made the announcement on the floor. He also touched on the other infrastructure spending bill, the $3.5 trillion that Democrats plan to pass on their own.
The two tracks of infrastructure are going to move in tandem. We're making good progress on both tracks. We in the Democratic caucus heard from the president yesterday on the budget resolution. The meeting was wonderful. The excitement was palpable. The opportunity to do so much good for so many American families was in the air in that meeting. It was exciting. And as that happened, the bipartisan working groups had many meetings on the bipartisan infrastructure framework as well. Today, I'm announcing that I intend to file cloture on the vehicle for a bipartisan infrastructure bill on Monday of next week. Senators will have until Wednesday of next week before the initial vote on cloture on the motion to proceed. Everyone has been having productive conversations, and it's important to keep the two-track process moving. All parties involved in the bipartisan infrastructure bill talks must now finalize their agreement so that the Senate can begin considering that legislation next week. And I am setting the same deadline next Wednesday for the entire Senate Democratic caucus to agree to move forward on the budget resolution with reconciliation instructions. The time has come to make progress, and we will.
The Senate Majority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer, on the Senate floor. That first vote next Wednesday on the bipartisan infrastructure bill, or the shell placeholder bill, if the final version is not ready, will need 60 votes to advance, and that means at least 10 Republicans needed to join the expected 50 members of the Democratic caucus voting yes. Republican Senator John Cornyn also speaking on the Senate floor about both infrastructure spending bills.
Mr. President, our Democratic colleagues have begun to lay out the groundwork for a partisan reconciliation bill totaling $3.5 trillion. What used to be an absolutely astonishing amount of money. We don't have many details about how that money could be spent, but based on everything we've heard from President Biden and our Democratic colleagues over recent months, there are some safe assumptions. Medicare expansion, Green New Deal era, climate initiatives, and a range of free programs that we know aren't free at all. College, childcare, you name it. To pay for these runaway spending habits, our Democratic colleagues will lean on job-killing tax increases and excessive borrowing from future generations. As a reminder, this is only one half of the dual-track strategy they're pushing this month. The other half is more than $1 trillion worth of infrastructure. And I would note that while there is strong bipartisan support for an infrastructure bill, that the Democratic leader is apparently intending to file for cloture on a motion to proceed to a bill that hasn't even been written yet, much less had a Congressional Budget Office score to see whether the pay-fors are meaningful or phony. As I see it, our friends on the other side have made it even more difficult to convince our colleagues, let alone the American people, that this type of spending is necessary. After all, they've already developed a spotty record this year. At a time when our debts were piling up, they added even more unnecessary spending.
Senator John Cornyn on the Senate floor and joining us now with more on the infrastructure spending bills and voting plans, Mike DeBonis, congressional reporter with The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us. Well, one of the running jokes the past few years has been this is infrastructure week. Next week, it really is. What did we learn today?
Well, thanks for having me. Next week, Senator Chuck Schumer announced this morning that he's going to tee up the first procedural vote to start the process of passing a bipartisan infrastructure plan that could put $1 trillion or more into, you know, the nation's road, bridges, broadband, internet, pipes, you name it. This is the culmination of months and months of talks, weeks of more intensive talks, and he is trying to move things forward quickly and force this group of Democrats and Republicans to come together and write an actual bill and get it moving.
Several Senate Republicans quoted today as saying Senator Schumer is moving a little bit too fast, sort of boxing them in. Any chance that they won't support a final version or vote for the shell bill if the final version is not available?
That's it. There's absolutely a chance of that. I think you've had several Republican senators say today that they really want this thing completely baked before taking any votes. I think that Senator Schumer and Democrats are betting that if things, stay on track, if they're still making progress, then the Republicans who support this aren't going to stand in the way. So I think that there's just a real desire to keep things moving on schedule and not allow negotiations to bog down or otherwise delay progress on this.
On the other infrastructure bill, the $3.5 trillion one funding human infrastructure, we heard yesterday that key Democratic Senator Joe Manchin was noncommittal. It's been another 24 hours. Any developments on whether all the Democrats will be on board on this?
You know, we're still working that out. I think no new news today from Manchin or really anybody else. Alongside that deadline that Schumer set today on the bipartisan bill, he also said that Democrats need to come together on the budget resolution and the reconciliation instructions that are included in that by the same day, Wednesday next week. So he is definitely trying to keep both of these two tracks, the trains on both of those two tracks, moving apace, and that is, going to require Democrats to come to some hard decisions, just as it's going to require Republicans on the other side, on the bipartisan side.
On that $3.5 trillion bill, you tweeted today with this lead line: "The corporate backlash begins." What did you mean?
Well, I think some of the things that are embedded into that $3.5 trillion proposal, could really overhaul the way the country deals with things like health care, community college, child care, a lot of different things. And that may threaten a lot of incumbent industries. We saw some signs of that today. The Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, Pharma, came out with a statement basically saying this was a non-starter, it would threaten people on Medicare. The other thing to note is it would possibly threaten the industry's revenue and profits. Democrats are looking at drug pricing legislation as part of this that could very dramatically reduce the amount the federal government spends on prescription drugs, and that's a real threat to the industry, and they're starting to mobilize.
The Senate Majority Leader Schumer saying today that getting these bills through is going to be long and tough. This is just the start. So what will you be watching for over the next week or two?
Well, a lot. I mean, if on the Democratic side, any one senator can, throw a wrench into the progress of the budget resolution. On the Republican side, you need 10 senators to join in with every Democrat. So we're just going to be very closely listening to the statements that each of these 100 senators make, because any one of them can make a difference.
Mike DeBonis, congressional reporter with The Washington Post. Follow him on Twitter at Mike DeBonis, and his stories at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And reports Thursday afternoon, this from The Hill, that bipartisan group of Senate negotiators looking to replace a proposal to provide $40 billion in new funding for the Internal Revenue Service, which is projected to net $100 billion in new revenues through tougher tax enforcement, because the idea drawing heat from conservatives. You can read more at thehill.com. Just one of many issues the group is working through. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell back on Capitol Hill for a second day of testimony on fiscal monetary policy, this time before the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. Republican Senator John Kennedy asking him about the increase in federal spending during the coronavirus pandemic and the plans for much more. Congressional Budget Office projecting federal budget deficit this fiscal year will be about $3 trillion. Here's Senator Kennedy and Fed Chair Powell.
We have spent an enormous amount of money. I mean, it's breathtaking. And now some agree with it, some disagree with it, but some say you shouldn't have done it. Some say we had to do it. It's probably a little bit of both. A lot of it wasn't paid for. And I look around, and President Biden is asking us in the next, 6 months to spend, another $5.5 trillion? And there's a lot of talk about pay-fors, but it won't all be paid for. We know that. At what point do these deficits matter? Are we living in a different world? I mean, I know you'll probably say, well, deficits always matter, but at what point does the marginal benefit of the extra deficit spending become less than the marginal cost?
I don't think there's a precise point that I can identify. I will say that we're not on a sustainable path. We actually haven't been for a long time. That just meaning that the debt is growing substantially faster than the economy. And in the long run, that is not sustainable. We're going to need to, that the laws of gravity have not been repealed. We will need to get back on a sustainable path at some point. I think the time to do that is when the economy is strong. Unemployment is low. Taxes are rolling in. That's the time to do it, and to do it, with a longer-term plan that matches up our spending needs and our revenues. That's what we're going to need to do. We will eventually have to do that.
When do you think that will be?
I wish I knew. I mean, I would say, the dollar is the world's reserve currency. People are buying our paper around the world. I don't think there's, any issue of being able to fund our deficits in the near term and the medium term. There's no evidence that there is, but we shouldn't wait until the urgent need arises.
Yeah, it's too late then. Everybody seems to be a Keynesian now, and that's fair. Dr. Keynes was brilliant, but some people forget about that chapter in one of his books where he said, okay, you deficit spend and you borrow to stimulate your economy, but when it's better, you pay it back. He said that very clearly. You pay it back.
Senator John Kennedy and Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell at today's Banking Committee hearing, part of the Chairman's semi-annual monetary report to Congress. You can find today's hearing and yesterday's before a House committee archived at cspan.org. The first monthly installments of the enhanced and expanded child tax credit, part of the coronavirus relief package President Biden signed into law in March, started hitting families' bank accounts today. IRS says payments for almost 60 million children, totaling $15 billion, went out. The payments will continue each month the rest of this year and in total make up half of the enhanced credit, which is $3,600 for each child under six and $3,000 for children ages 6 to 17. For families that do qualify, there are income limits, and the rest of the credit will be given as a lump sum when tax returns are filed next year. Vice President Kamala Harris joined President Biden in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building next to the White House to tout this new benefit. Here's the Vice President.
Let us mark this day, Thursday, July 15th, 2021, as the day the American family got so much stronger. Today, the expanded child tax credit is here. today for families all over our country, for children all over our country. Help is here. It is a good day, America. And I'll tell you, you know, my mother, she worked hard at being a mother. Whether it was waking up at the crack of dawn to pack our lunches and get us ready for school, or whether after we went to bed, sitting at our kitchen table and trying to just figure out how to make it all work. And I know it wasn't easy, even though she never said that. My family's story is not all that remarkable. It is the story of the American family. Parents who will do anything for their children. Parents who work so hard every day. Parents who deserve their government and their leaders to really see them, to really understand them as they juggle all their responsibilities every month. Every month, the rent becomes due. Every month, the child care provider needs a check that could take half an income. Every month, American families need to buy groceries and gas to pay for rent or homeowners insurance, utilities, and car loans. And even if they have enough to make ends meet, it is often just barely enough. One unexpected expense could mean the difference between taking on more debt or losing it all. In the wealthiest nation in the world, it should not be this way. And the president and I, well, we both believe that. So when we took office, we set out to provide American families with some relief. And that is exactly what we are doing.
Vice President Kamala Harris joining President Biden in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building today, part of the White House complex. A story in the Wall Street Journal offers this caution about the child tax credit monthly payments. They write, for many families, the prepayments could bring unwelcome surprises next spring. The IRS is making the payments based on income shown on 2020 and sometimes 2019 returns. So families whose income has risen or has had other changes could have to pay back some or all of the prepayments on their 2021 tax returns. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 53, NASDAQ down 101, S&P down 14. Labor Department says the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits reaching its lowest level since the coronavirus pandemic struck last year, 360,000 last week, down 26,000 from the week before. Back in January, unemployment claims were over 900,000. On coronavirus vaccinations, the rate in the U.S. now about 68% with at least one shot, that's adults, and the White House is in the middle of a renewed push to reach the rest, but it may not be easy. This from the Washington Post, what began as vaccine hesitancy has morphed into outright vaccine hostility as conservatives increasingly attack the White House's coronavirus message, mischaracterize its vaccination campaign, and more vowed to skip the shots altogether. Today, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, speaking about his new advisory on the harmful effects of health misinformation.
As all of you know, we've come a long way in our fight against COVID-19, and we've come a long way thanks to the efforts of many, many people across communities in the United States. Right now, we are seeing COVID deaths markedly down from their peak in January. We have 160 million people who have been fully vaccinated. And hundreds of thousands of people each day are choosing to get vaccinated. That is all good news. But we are not out of the woods yet. Millions of Americans are still not protected against COVID-19, and we are seeing more infections among those who are unvaccinated. And that's why I want to talk to you today about one of the biggest obstacles that's preventing us from ending this pandemic. Today, I issued a Surgeon General's advisory on the dangers of health misinformation. Surgeon General advisories are reserved for urgent public health threats. And while those threats have often been related to what we eat, drink, and smoke, today we live in a world where misinformation poses an imminent and insidious threat to our nation's health. Health misinformation is false, inaccurate, or misleading information about health, according to the best evidence at the time. And while it often appears innocuous on social media apps, on retail sites, or search engines, the truth is that misinformation takes away our freedom to make informed decisions about our health and the health of our loved ones. During the COVID-19 pandemic, health misinformation has led people to resist wearing masks in high-risk settings. It's led them to turn down proven treatments and to choose not to get vaccinated. This has led to avoidable illnesses and death. Simply put, health information has cost us lives. Now, health misinformation didn't start with COVID-19. What's different now, though, is the speed and scale at which health misinformation is spreading. Modern technology companies have enabled misinformation to poison our information environment with little accountability to their users.
The U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, in the White House briefing room. He also made a personal plea with Americans to get vaccinated and stop spreading this misinformation. And he said coronavirus has taken a terrible toll on his own family. 10 of his family members, both in the U.S. and India, have died from COVID-19. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Former President Donald Trump attacking General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, over reports that he sought to prevent Trump from orchestrating a government takeover after the 2020 election, in a similar vein that the Nazis did to seize control of Germany. Trump writing that the idea is so ridiculous, and sorry to inform you, Trump writes, but an election is my form of coup, and if I was going to do a coup, one of the last people I would want to do it with is General Mark Milley. State Department offering rewards up to $10 million for information leading to the identification of anyone engaged in foreign state-sanctioned malicious cyber activity against critical U.S. infrastructure, including ransomware attacks. The Biden administration announcing new protections for Alaska's Tongass National Forest, including an end to large-scale old-growth logging, and a proposal to prohibit road development on more than 9 million acres. This reverses decisions by former President Trump. And a jury has found the gunman who killed 5 people in the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland in 2018 criminally responsible, rejecting the defense attorney's mental illness arguments. Prosecutors seeking 5 life sentences for Jared Ramos without the possibility of parole. Associated Press writing, President Joe Biden welcomes German Chancellor Angela Merkel to the White House on Thursday for what is likely her last official visit to Washington, and she's conveying a message to Berlin's close ally, you've got a friend. Merkel is not seeking another term in Germany's elections this year after nearly 16 years as leader. One of the topics during a joint news conference in the White House East Room, relations with Russia and the controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline, energy pipeline, between Russia and Germany, a project that Germany supports and the U.S. opposes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chancellor. Mr. President, allow me, if I may, to ask a question as regards Nord Stream 2. Madam Chancellor, you just said that you would act actively should Russia be in breach of its commitments, for example, interrupt gas transit through Ukraine. What do you mean in concrete terms? Will Germany then switch off Nord Stream 2 from the German side? And what sort of legal grounds would you be sort of claiming? Mr. President, you have fought so many years, the U.S. has fought so many years against Nord Stream 2. Now there will be only a few days left until this pipeline comes into operation. Why will you allow it to go ahead, to put it in operation, or will the people who operate this system actually have to contend with sanctions on the horizon? Well, Mr. Kühnert, says the Chancellor, you know that we've worked a lot, not only Germany, incidentally, but the whole of the European Commission, for talking to Russia and Ukraine, negotiating a treaty that ensures until 2023 the gas contract, and after that gas deliveries must be possible as well. That is what I've heard. At least, let me be very careful here in my wording. And then, should that not go ahead, we have a number of instruments at our disposal, which are not necessarily on the German side, but on the European side, for example, sanctions as regards Crimea or breach of the Minsk Treaty has shown that we have those sanctions, these instruments at our disposal. We have possibilities to react. We are in contact with our European friends. depends on this, but at the point in time of which I hope we will never have to take those decisions, you will then see what we do.
My view on Nord Stream 2 has been known for some time. Good friends can disagree. By the time I became president, it was 90% completed. And imposing sanctions did not seem to make any sense. It made more sense to work with the chancellor on finding out how she proceed based on whether or not Russia tried to essentially blackmail Ukraine in some way. So the chancellor and I have asked our teams to look at practical measures we could take together whether or not Europe energy security, Ukraine security are actually strengthened or weakened based on Russian actions. And so this is a we'll see. We'll see.
President Joe Biden, part of the joint news conference with the visiting German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the White House. Reuters explains that Russia is racing to finish the pipeline that would take Russian gas to Germany and deprive Ukraine of valuable transit fees. Cuba's communist rulers said they'll ease restrictions on food and medicine imports and pledge to learn from the rare display of public anger and mass protests over the weekend. That's reporting from Bloomberg News. Debate continuing in the U.S. over how the U.S. should respond. Here is Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican, on the Senate floor.
Over the past few days, the world has seen that the American people, we stand squarely with the men and women of Cuba in their noble fight for liberty. Worryingly, however, the Biden administration has stopped short of strong, clear support for the brave protesters marching in the street and has been reluctant to issue clear and unequivocal condemnation for the communist dictatorship that oppresses those people. In statement after statement, as protesters swept into the streets, literally risking their lives to stand for freedom, administration officials have issued lukewarm and guarded statements. After being shamed into finally taking stronger positions, President Biden finally put out a statement saying that the protesters were exercising their right to peaceful assembly. But even that is wrong. In Cuba, they have no right to peaceful assembly because the Cuban dictatorship is out there arresting the protesters right now. It's out there beating the protesters right now. It's out there imprisoning the protesters right now. They are speaking with great courage, and the communist dictatorship is doing everything it can to silence what they're saying. The Biden administration has also said the protests are about COVID-19 vaccines. That unfortunately doesn't even pass the laugh test. Just this week, the White House press secretary said the protests were about misadministration in Cuba, mismanagement. Well, the last I checked, the protesters in the streets weren't chanting, "Manage better." They were chanting libertad, freedom. They were chanting down with the dictatorship.
Senator Ted Cruz on the Senate floor. His father fled Cuba in 1957, seeking political asylum in the U.S. after being targeted for opposing the regime then in power. Later at the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about the Biden administration's position on the Cuban protests.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Jen. Now that you've had a few days to think about it, does this White House still think the protests in Cuba are happening because people are upset about a rise in COVID cases there, or is there some thought maybe given to the possibility that they are protesting because they are sick of communism?
Well, Peter, first I would say communism is a failed ideology, and we certainly believe that. It has failed the people of Cuba. They deserve freedom. they deserve a government that supports them, whether that is making sure they have health and medical supplies, access to vaccines, or whether they have economic opportunity and prosperity. And instead, this has been a government, an authoritarian communist regime that has repressed its people and has failed the people of Cuba. Hence, we're seeing them in the streets. But I would note that the ideology of the government, which has failed, has led to a lack of access to economic opportunity, to medical supplies, to COVID vaccines. So all of those pieces are true.
And there are protesters now in this country who are chanting as these protests in Cuba are going on, where is Biden? So where is he? What is he doing to protect these people who are rising up against the leaders of this failed experiment?
Well, first, he is certainly advocating for and speaking out as we've put out a statement, multiple statements. Maybe one of you will ask him a question about Cuba today. I will leave it to all of you to determine that. One, he has made clear that he stands with the Cuban people and their call for freedom from both the pandemic and from decades of repression and economic suffering to which they've been subjected by Cuba's authoritarian regime. There is an ongoing review of our own policies. And as we look at those policies, one of the big factors is ensuring we are not doing anything to pad the pockets of a corrupt authoritarian regime. And that is certainly a factor as he's considering. But we're looking closely at how we can help in a humanitarian way, how we can help support the voices of the Cuban people. And there's an ongoing policy review in that regard.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And in fact, a reporter did ask President Biden later at that joint news conference with the German chancellor about Cuba. And the president saying communism is a failed system, universally failed system, and I don't see socialism as a very useful substitute. And the president went on to say that they were considering different ways to help the Cuban people, but he said it would require a different circumstance or a guarantee they would not be taken advantage of by the government. He said, for example, the ability to send remittances back to Cuba. We would not do that now because the fact is it's highly likely the regime would confiscate those remittances or big chunks of it. President Biden also asked about Haiti during that joint news conference, and he said that the U.S. will not send U.S. troops to Haiti after last week's assassination of that country's president, with the exception of Marines to bolster security at the U.S. Embassy in Haiti. President Biden's nominee to lead ICE Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Ed Gonzalez, testifying before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Gonzalez is the sheriff of Harris County, Texas, which is the third largest sheriff's office in the U.S., 5,000 employees, a jurisdiction covering 4.5 million people. Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, asking the nominee about the Biden administration's immigration policies.
With regard to the administration's recent decision to effectively end deportation of those aliens who entered illegally prior to November 1st, 2020, isn't this just a free pass for those who arrived here over 6 months ago? I mean, I don't understand this. Give me your view. I mean, this sounds like a free pass to me. Isn't this a free pass for anybody who came before November 2020?
The ones that came before, in my understanding of the guidance that's been offered, doesn't preclude anyone still that's here unlawful to not be still removed. So I think that it's still there. I think it's just a matter of prioritizing key areas, and I think that it doesn't preclude anyone that's here unlawfully from being removed,
so,
in my opinion.
Okay, good. So you would be, I think you're telling me that you would attempt to enforce the law and to remove those who came to this country illegally in violation of our laws before November 1st, 2020. Is that correct?
Part of the role of ICE is to conduct enforcement operations. I think that those obviously have to be prioritized when we're considering limited operations and resources. I think that we do that every day. There's a lot of crimes on the books, but it's a matter of trade-offs. It's making sure that we're focusing on a strategic approach that goes after those individuals that do pose the greatest danger to the integrity of our border, public safety, and national security.
But here's my problem with the discussion about priorities. Since this administration has come to office, the number of ICE arrests has plunged. It has plunged. The Trump administration, I think, arrested over 6,000 people. arrests, 6,000 arrests per month on average in the final months of the last presidency. There were 10,000 a month before the pandemic. So far, this is according to the Washington Post, by the way, so these are public numbers. So far in this administration, ICE officers have made about 2,500 arrests during the Biden presidency. Now, that's a dramatic drop in difference. It sounds to me like what's being prioritized is not the husbanding of resources. What's being prioritized is not arresting criminals and not arresting people who are here illegally. What I'd like to get from you is a commitment that you will vigorously enforce our laws that are on the books and will make ICE's mission to do so a priority. Can you give me that commitment?
Yes, sir. I am familiar with the article. To me, the one data point, in my experience, I would like to see more data. To see what other factors may have played into that to better understand the numbers. It is concerning. So I would make sure, then again, that if we're being strategic and we're prioritizing properly, that we could go after those individuals that pose the greatest threat to our communities. I think that's reasonable and appropriate, but we would be aggressive in going after them.
Ed Gonzalez, nominated to lead ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, questioned by Senator Josh Hawley. Also testifying at today's hearing, another nominee to lead the U.S. Census Bureau, Robert Santos. And Senator Rob Portman asked Santos about whether census data used for drawing congressional and state legislative districts would be released next month.
Ohio, Mr. Santos, is working on redistricting, as you know. Incredibly important. I mean, there are people who are thinking of running for office, but they don't know what the districts look like because we can't get the data from the Census Bureau. And it's been a disaster in Ohio, and I'm sure other states feel the same. We have a commission now, and that commission has a deadline of maps being due for the legislative districts on September 1st, and then congressional districts, the maps and plans are due on September 30th. And with no other options, I supported Attorney General Yost's lawsuit against the Census Bureau to get the data, because without the data, we can't draw the lines. And again, literally, people don't know what districts to run in. Constituents don't know what district they're going to be in. And the lawsuit ended up with the Bureau agreeing to provide this data by August 16th. Now, remember, I said September 1st is a deadline, so August 16th is not much time to put together the plan. And that date cannot slip. Can I ask you today, if you are confirmed, will you commit today to ensuring that that deadline is met, that we have no further delay in getting the Census Bureau data?
Thank you for that question, Senator. I very much sympathize with the concerns of the state of Ohio in advancing democracy with redistricting. I understand the urgency. I also understand the importance of having accurate information in order to make the critical decisions that drive our democracy. I also understand the timeliness. Timeliness is an element of data quality that it has only relatively recently been recognized as something that's crucial and that we need to take into account when we're developing data products. So I am with you in terms of wanting to produce data by the dates that have been committed to. I have full confidence in the Census Bureau, the career staff, the excellent data processors.
Robert Santos, nominated for U.S. Census Bureau Director, questioned by Senator Rob Portman. Santos is a third-generation Mexican-American who, if confirmed, would be the first person of color to be a permanent head of the Census Bureau. House Democrats advancing a federal government spending bill for fiscal year 2022 that does not include the Hyde Amendment. That's a provision that bans federal funding for most abortions, named after the late Republican Congressman Henry Hyde of Illinois. During today's House Appropriations Committee markup of the funding bill that includes the Health and Human Services Department, Republican Kay Granger spoke in opposition.
For the first time in nearly 50 years, this bill abandons longstanding bipartisan language that prevents federal tax dollars from being used to pay for abortions. The bill also removes language carried for the last 16 years that protects American doctors and nurses from being forced to participate in abortions. This is the first time in such an extreme position has been taken in this bill, and this shift in policy could actually destroy decades of bipartisan work. There are many other controversial items included in the bill that must also be addressed, including language relating to labor law, excessive spending on new unauthorized programs, and provisions relating to immigration enforcement. Madam Chair, Republicans stand ready to discuss top line spending levels and funding for individual programs that will help improve the health and lives of the American people. But restoring language that protects the lives of unborn children and protects medical professionals from being forced to participate in abortions must be the first step.
Congresswoman Kay Granger, who is ranking Republican on the Appropriations Committee. A Democratic member of the committee, Lois Frankel, applauded the decision to keep the Hyde Amendment out of this spending bill.
I want to just say this is a truly historic bill that eliminates the cruel barriers to reproductive care for working women struggling to make ends meet. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Barbara Lee, for your leadership on this. We have eliminated for the first time in decades a racist, discriminatory policy of blocking Medicaid beneficiaries from accessing abortion. And we do this while making historic investments in Title X Family Planning Program, which provides birth control, STD screenings, HIV treatment, breast and cervical cancer screenings, and more to millions of low-income patients in our most underserved communities each year. We recognize that the decision to become a parent is a personal one to be made by each woman and not by politicians.
Congresswoman Lois Frankel at today's Appropriations Committee markup. Next step, as the bill comes out of committee, is to head to the full House of Representatives for a debate and a vote. If it passes there, of course, it would have to go to the Senate and be passed there. Then the same version would have to pass both the House and Senate and be signed into law by the president before this could ever become law. Thanks for being with us today on Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts and download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen anywhere, not only to C-SPAN Radio, but the audio streams of the three C-SPAN TV networks. Have a good evening. We'll see you tomorrow.